Welcome to Radio Free Albion with Tony Trigilio. My guest today is Susan Schultz. I'll be talking with Susan about her newest books, Memory Cards 2010-2011 series, and She's Welcome to Her Disease, Dementia Blog Volume 2. Welcome to Radio Free Albion. This is Tony Trigilio, and I'm talking today via Skype with Susan Schultz. Susan Schultz's newest book is Memory Cards, 2010-2011 series, prose poems composed to fit on a time card or an index card, and it was published in 2011 by Singing Horse Press. She's also the author of four previous books of poetry and poetic prose, including Dementia Blog, also published by Singing Horse in 2008. She's the editor of the anthology Jack London is Dead, Contemporary Euro-American Poetry in Hawaii and Some Stories, which was published in 2012 by Tinfish Press. And her critical work includes the book A Poetics of Impasse in Modern and Contemporary Poetry, which was published in 2005 by the University of Alabama Press. She founded Tinfish Press in 1995, and I should add it's a vital home for experimental literature. She lives and teaches in Hawaii and is a lifelong fan of the St. Louis Cardinals. And you knew I had to add that. How are you doing, Susan?
Well, I'm doing fine. Thank you, Tony, for mentioning the Cardinals with such a fine tone in your voice.
Well, I love that everywhere I see your official author bio, you always include the Cardinals.
I do.
And as I was thinking about how, you know, the questions for the interview and just sort of visualizing how the interview would go, every time I'd get to the Cardinal part, I would laugh. And I'd get this wonderful image in my head. When I was a kid, my dad and I always argued about Ted Simmons's long hair.
Oh, Ted, yeah, the catcher.
Yeah. Oh, my! It would drive my father crazy. He'd always be like, I don't know whether that guy, he's a man or a woman. And I'd be like, well, Jesus, you know, he's a catcher for the Cardinals. I think he's a man, you know.
Right. A good one at that.
And a really good one, yeah. And then one time I said to him, well, people say that to me sometimes because I was a kid and we went to get gas and the guy, you know, was still when they would pump your gas for you. And
right.
The guy said, made some joke about whether I was a girl or a boy and was my hair, you know, and I said that to him one time when he mentioned Ted Simmons, and then the argument went in an entirely different.
Oh, that was a mistake, Tony.
Really bad move.
That was a bad move. But I remember one time, I forget who it was. It might have been Leonard Schwartz or somebody was pestering me about why on earth are you a Cardinals fan? You know, I don't live in St. Louis. I never have. I was born near there, but I wasn't there for long. And he finally looked at me and he said, oh, I get it. It's an identity issue. And ever since I've thought, yeah, that's what it is. It's just part of me for whatever odd reason.
It's absolutely an identity issue. I've been a Red Sox fan for most of my life, and I grew up in Pennsylvania, not really close to Boston at all. But you know, like first I was a Mets fan because my brother would hit me if I didn't root for the Mets, so I had this this impetus to root for them. And then they traded Tom Seaver, and my life changed completely. And I just sort of like gravitated toward the Red Sox has an identity issue, and then they become a sickness because they're the Red Sox. But still, you know, it's like, I know exactly right. What you mean.
But do you feel different as a Red Sox fan now that they have won a couple World Series?
Yes, I do. I feel different. Like when they won the series in 2004, and I'm sorry that they beat the Cardinals, so I have to add that.
So am I. So am I.
But then at least you had 2006, and I was really happy for that.
Yeah.
When they won in 2004, people would say to me, "Well, well, what's it going to be like? Like, it's probably not going to be as much fun being a Red Sox fan, because you won't be able to whine about it. And especially close friends would be like, oh, when you whine about the Red Sox, it's so entertaining. And now you won't be able to whine about it. And I just would be like, it's so great to have this thing happen and winning that I would never see in my lifetime, that I can take not whining. It's fine.
Oh, that's good.
It was
That's
really
good.
good. And then they became detestable as human beings in 2011. So now I have a new kind of whining, but they've won, and that that obstacle in my psychic life is gone, and I'm really happy that it's gone.
Yeah, that's good.
So let's talk about mem well, I would like to talk about baseball. I could do that for hours, but and I'm sure you could too.
Yes.
Let's talk about memory cards. I'm thinking, like, if you could talk a little bit about what they are, sort of conceptually, what's behind them, and also maybe physically, why they should be seen as index cards or time cards.
Okay. I wrote my first set of memory cards in the late 90s and I think the year 2000. And I wrote them because I had moved from writing verse to writing prose. And I had been writing this long prose piece. Like I got to page maybe 100, page 150 or so when I realized that it really was not worth keeping. But I thought parts of it were okay, and they were these small chunks. So I started plucking small chunks out and putting them together. And next thing I knew, I realized that each of these chunks of prose fit on a large index card. So what I did was I simply moved into writing pieces that fit on the index card. So each new piece would fit on the index card. And it was a way for me to combine what was happening at the moment that I was writing the card and things that came up in memory, and allowing them the space to jostle up against one another, and finally, in some odd way or other, kind of resolve into an idea or an image or a sound or something. So I wrote that first set, and it was published in 2001. And then just a couple years ago, I started feeling the need to write another set of them. So I started writing them. And then I went to our local stationery office supply store called Fisher, which is just a wonderful old warehouse. And I was looking for big index cards, but in lieu of them, I found time cards. And they're about
Like
the same
actual time
size.
cards, time.
Actual time
Oh,
cards
this is
that
great. Okay.
you would sign into work, you would put your name down, you would write down your hours. And so I purchased some of those and used those because, of course, those seem even better. Time cards, memory cards. And then after that, of course, I had to put at the end that I'm a St. Louis Cards fan. So everything seemed to fit together well. But in this last stretch of them, things that were going on were my mother's Alzheimer's, a lot of issues that were coming up in Hawaii as usual, a lot about adopting our daughter. We adopted her in 2004, but there was a lot of kind of moving back and forth between my mother's forgetting and my daughter really coming into her own. So all of those things were jostling for attention. And this time around, just to say one more thing, I did them in sequences of 10, and I would pick for each sequence a poet that had been very influential to me, and I would simply open their book, one of their books. Find a passage at random, like a line, and start from there. So it became a kind of homage to my own memory of whatever canon it was that formed me as a poet.
And I want to thank you for choosing Dickinson and Oppen, two of my favorite poets. I mean, I like all the poets in there, but when there was a moment where Dickinson is evoked early, and then there's the Dickinson section, and then there's the Oppen section, and I feel like you've got, the compressed language of Dickinson and Oppen, and then something a little more expansive at times with Ashbery. It really adds a dynamic voice to the poets you're writing through in the book.
Yeah, the Ashbery, really, the sentences got longer and more flowing, and with some of the other poets like Dickinson, everything got much more taut. I don't believe that anything is really random. So what I found when I was doing them was these odd conjunctions of poet and time period. So I just happened to be doing Apen at the time of the Egyptian revolution in Tahrir Square, and that seemed to be perfectly fitting. And then I was interested in doing a sequence on Albert Saijo, and that happened at the time that I went to Oregon and did some thinking about the internment camp experience. He had spent time in an internment camp. So there were interesting moves back and forth between the poets and the everyday, along with everything else that was going on.
And that movement between the poets and the everyday, like the memory and the present moment, it really produces some weird, and I mean this in a really great way, weird conjunctions. Like in one of the Oppen poems, you go from Oppen to football to Tahrir Square, and it doesn't. Yeah, and it's great. I don't feel like I've just got whiplash of like, oh yes, of course, they're all kind of stitched together in this poem. And it makes Oppen and football even more political than they might have already seemed before the poem.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the way in which you're thinking of two things that are completely separate and they actually turn out to be in conversation with each other is what really interests me in this particular kind of writing.
And there's kind of like a faith almost that they will be in conversation with each other. Like when you said, when you were talking about how you composed them and you said you picked the quotations from the poets, you just opened up the book at random. I got kind of energized thinking, yeah, this is how often, influences or material that I might be appropriating comes out at random, but I do that with a faith that it's not really as random as it seems.
Yeah, I do. I will confess that I would start each sequence doing it perfectly randomly, but then as you get a sense of where you're going and why you're going there, I would then cheat occasionally and actually look for a particular passage, which is probably why it was best that I would stop each one at 10, because they started getting more and more determined as I got, somewhere around 5 or 6.
I love that. So it becomes like it starts random, then it becomes shaped, and then you draw a boundary and say, oh gosh, it's going to be way too shaped. I've got to stop here.
Yeah, and that was how I felt about the whole project, actually, was that by the end of what is this collection, I was thinking that I could probably write these things forever. I could write one a day for the rest of my life and maybe one more life, but they would start to get very predictable to me and probably to everybody else. So I just stopped them for the moment, thinking, maybe in 10 more years I'll go back.
Yeah, to sort of have the sense to know that to stop it before something does really get exhausted.
Right,
Yeah,
right.
yeah. It's a, that's a, it's tough sometimes to have your to catch that with your antenna. I always have my antenna out for that, and I hope I'm catching it, but I have to rely on other poets reading my work to tell me sometimes when to stop.
Well, and it's kind of a sad moment too, because I remember
Yes.
also with the Dementia Blog book that I was in fine writing form when I suddenly had this voice in my head that said, stop now because it's going to get completely redundant. And so I stopped, I obeyed the voice in my head, and then eventually, after a year, I went back to that project, although it started to be shaped in different ways. And the second volume of that work is going to be coming out this spring, again from Singing Horse. But I really needed to stop when I stopped that first time.
And so the second half of Dementia Blog is coming out soon then.
Yeah, fairly soon.
Oh, that's great. And I want to talk about Dementia Blog a little bit later because it's definitely feels like a companion book to Memory Cards.
Yes, they definitely have a lot of overlaps.
And what I like that's, I think it's really powerful in both, and I'll just focus on Memory Cards right now, but it's definitely in both books that the way the poems evoke really intense feeling. And that feeling is mediated through language, memory, and specifically because you're talking about your mother, mediated through forgetting also.
Right. Yeah. So they're memory cards that deal with forgetting, which is an irony that I think is especially sharp, I guess.
I was going to smoothly when you moved from their memory card, when you said there are memory cards that deal with forgetting, I was going to really smoothly and eloquently quote from one of them as if it's just like on the tip of my tongue. And then I stumbled a bit, so now I'm going to admit I opened the book to a page I'd marked. Things are never really as smooth as they should be. I'm thinking of the August 20th, excuse me, August 23rd, 2010. Entry or poem. I see, I'm gonna call it an entry because it has that diaristic feel.
Right, yeah.
Invisibility is not censorship, is forgetting. We are forgotten for, not spoken. And then later, this is when the Dickinson moment comes, the first Dickinson moment comes in, and then a plankton in reason broke. And I, it's there's these aren't just like one. I guess I'm reading that section of the book as a way of getting at the idea that. When we're talking about memory and forget, when you're talking about memory and forgetting in the book, it feels like I'm part of this larger conversation about language and power and memory and forgetting. Like you said, you're working with what's going on in your life in the present moment, in Hawaiian politics and global politics also. But I never feel like the political is imposed on the poems. It feels like they're really kind of co-emerging with the everyday details from your life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think as someone who often keeps on whatever is the least offensive cable television, quote unquote, news network. Almost all the time, it's just something that's always there, and always has been for me that whatever's going on in the world is very much present, but present with all these other things that might be exceedingly personal or might be intellectual or cultural or and that doesn't mean that they're all, of equal value, but they're all equally present. And so I like to think about that in these pieces too.
I,
Right.
oh, go ahead. Yes.
Well, when I was doing the first set of them, I remember we had a mail carrier at the time, a really interesting woman who'd been a concert pianist and given it up for the good state federal job. And she found out I was a poet, so she said, "Oh, do you like walk up in the mountains for inspiration?" And I said, "No, I just sit at my desk and listen to the neighbors screaming obscenities at each other, and I write them down." So it's just a different notion of taking down what's around you, whatever it happens to be, and using that as the material.
I should say when you're telling the story of listening to the neighbors scream, people can't see what I'm doing here, but I'm laughing, but then I'm trying not to laugh as hard as I really want to laugh because then it'll overwhelm audio. The audio will overwhelm what you're saying. But I'm thinking, yeah, it's like you mind your you know the story reminded me of the one of my favorite South Park episodes where Cartman says to Kyle, why don't you just go sit under a rainbow and write a poem? So I always say that to my students when we're getting into that like uber pastoral mode. I'm like, let's just be happy and go sit under a rainbow and write a poem. And then we all look at each other and we're like, well, of course we can't do that. It's really the people arguing near us where the poem comes from, I think.
Right.
And we're talking about politics. And in a second, I want to, maybe we can hear a poem from memory cards, but we're talking about politics, and I should let everyone know the hundreds of trillions of people who are listening to this podcast that Susan is the only poet and editor who ever has sent a book on my behalf to Roger Ailes, the president of Pravda, or I mean the North Korean news agency. No, of course, I mean Fox News. And he's my favorite war criminal, swimming in blood like Kissinger. So I'm always grateful to you for doing that.
Well, you were one of the few people who took me up on the war criminal special from Tin Fish Press. So I was very pleased to do that. I sent my own to actually I sent two of my own. I sent the first one to Henry Kissinger. It was a book by a Cambodian who'd survived the Khmer Rouge genocide, so I thought Kissinger was good. But then at the time I found out, oh my God, what was his name? He was the Marine Corps general who was on the Joint Chiefs. Oh Lord, what was his name? Anyway, it turned out somehow he was living in my parents' old house.
Oh my
And
God.
so, because I certainly knew his address at that point, I simply sent him a copy too, and never heard back. But I def yeah, I sent one for you. That's a good memory.
I always appreciated that. And you didn't hear back from that Marine general, but who knows what kind of poems it might have inspired for him. He's somewhere like sitting under a rainbow writing a poem
Right.
and like, reloading his M16 probably too.
Right. Now it's just going to bother me no end that I don't remember his name. It had peas in it, lots of
Oh,
peas
God.
in it. My husband, who was just napping behind me, awoke long enough to say Petraeus, but that was not it. It was he was Joint Chiefs of Staff under Bush,
Okay, Joint Chiefs of
and he was
Staff.
the Marine Corps guy.
Okay. Peter Pace.
Peter Pace, that's the one.
Thank you, Google, for giving us the name of another war criminal. All right. Peter
And as I
Pace.
recall, we also made these nice little slips of paper that were like, a free copy from Tin Fish Press to the war criminal of your choice or something, and we would slip those in
Oh.
before we sent them.
Oh, that was just one of the best promotions I'd ever found, because it's just like, if someone for some reason didn't know Tin Fish, they'd see that and have to think, well, my God, I've any press that's going to send books to war criminals, I have to see their entire catalog.
They're not all appropriate for war criminals, but that one definitely was.
Was that corpse watching? Was that
That was corpse
That was
watching.
perfect for Kissinger-like war criminals, definitely.
It definitely was.
Well, let's hear a poem from Memory Cards.
Okay, well, I mentioned a couple of poems that I'd be happy to read. If you would rather hear one from the Oppen series or Dickinson, just let me know.
Why don't let's go with the ones that you wanted to, just instead, I don't want to impose that on your reading.
Oh, I don't mind. But okay, let me read the first one that I had chosen, which is from it's the first series of poems. It's the Lyssa Wolsack series. Lyssa being a very wonderful poet who lives in Vancouver, and is not as well known as she ought to be in the poetry world. So this is July 21st, 2010. Let us finish each other's songs. She chants the Kumulipo in the back seat. How do you read the bumper sticker, Bloodlines? You are not my mother. Sight memory, muscle memory. My mother has forgotten how to walk. Her throat forgets to swallow. Parse the word for, forward, fortunate, fortuitous, not against, but with. Get, claim, hold, beget. If my mother forgets me, am I misbegotten? Mother is a job, he tells her. It's the person who takes you to school, who makes sure you're safe. At day's end, she gets you back.
You're listening to Susan Schultz on Radio Free Albion, and that was a poem from Memory Cards 2010-2011 series. It was the July 21st, 2010 poem. When you were reading that, as I was hearing it, I was thinking, oh, I really want to talk about the body and language, especially the powerful moment. My mother has forgotten how to walk, her throat forgets to swallow. But then hearing it again, something else kind of grabbed me. It was, if my mother forgets me, am I misbegotten? That sense of when a parent is suffering from, dementia, and they start to forget who you are, what that does to your sense to your sense of who you are.
Right. I had found that it came on so slowly that by the time it actually happened, it wasn't as painful as it might seem. But recently I read something by someone who said that just as in many illnesses or conditions, there's always one question that everybody asks you. The one question that you get asked all the time if your mother has Alzheimer's is, does she remember who you are? For some reason, that's on the tip of everyone's tongue. So I was kind of using that as, well, if she doesn't remember you, then what does that mean about you?
And who are you then? And as you say,
And
am I misbegotten, which sounds so much like forgotten.
right, and forget has within it the concept of getting or, giving life to, begetting. So the word itself seems to have packed in it all of these aspects of the problem. And then the other thing going on in the poem is that there was a brief period of time where my adopted daughter would say, "You're not my mother," because people kept telling her, that you have a real mother, do you know who she is, and all of that. And so we had this family discussion about what is a mother. And so that whole kind of coming together of the what is a mother, you have an adopted mother, and then you have a mother who kind of doesn't know you anymore. All of those things came together in this, and for some reason, the word forget seemed to be crucial to unpacking all of it.
And in the story of your daughter too, I'm thinking of how beget and forget really embed themselves in each other.
Right. And then at the very beginning of the poem, the Kumolipo is the Hawaiian creation chant. So it starts with the creation chant, which my daughter used to, after hula, she would chant that in the back seat of the car. And then there's a bumper sticker that you often see on bumpers in Hawaii that says bloodlines, which would seem in the context of Hawaii politics to have to do with Native Hawaiian issues, although it turns out that it actually has to do with a certain kind of clothing. So that the bumper sticker is actually an ad, but I think it's often being used for this other reason. So again, these words are kind of flashing in and out of contextualized meaning as they're appearing in the poem.
And as you were talking about bloodlines as an ad, that's where my gasp came in because I, you know, as you said, the book is about or about you know the book it you know engages everything that's happening to you in your everydayness, and we can't get away from how you know these really important, profound questions of identity are coexisting with some ad that you see on the bumper sticker of a car.
Exactly. Yes. Always. All the
Oh.
time.
And
Yeah.
more and more, yeah. I want to talk a little bit about, and this is related to what we're saying about forgetting and begetting and language. I talk a little bit about Dementia Blog, which, as you said, the next book in the sequel, I guess we call it, the follow-up to Dementia Blog is coming out next year from Singing Horse,
No,
right?
it's coming out just in a couple months.
Oh, in a couple of months from.
It's coming out soon.
Okay, excellent. So, Dementia Blog, the companion, the next book in the series, is coming out in a couple months from Singing Horse. And, you know, when it came out, I read it more slowly than I normally would read a book of poems, and it was really personal for me because I was facing some of these questions about forgetting and my father. It coincided with like the worst parts of his senility, his increasing sen and then eventually within a year of it coming out, he had passed away. And it was really forcing me to pay closer attention to what he was going through and to what you know my role was as his son. And there were these moments where, and if we go back to baseball for a moment, where he would forget I was a Red Sox fan, and that really messed with my sense of identity and who I was. Like I would call him, and it got to the point where baseball was sometimes the only thing we could really, really talk about. And I would say something like, "Well, it was great. Did you see that Sunday night game? The Red Sox beat the Yankees." And then he would seem so unmoved by that. And then I would keep going and talking about how happy it was. And then he'd say, "Oh yeah, that's right. You're a Red Sox fan.
Oh,
How can you
yeah.
forget that about who I am?"
Right.
So it's a real struggle. And I think I was feeling a kind of struggle with Dementia Blog, but it was a struggle that was part of the book's power, and I'm wondering if you can talk about the book a little bit more, and you could probably guess the next part of my question. I'm sure everyone asks this. If you can talk a little bit about the backwards in time motion, that the book
Okay.
gets from blog, it's predictable, but it's really important, I think.
Okay. Well, it came out of a blog that I was keeping when I started writing it, which was not called Dementia Blog at all. It was a blog that had to do with family travels, and it was really only for family and friends. And at the end of the summer that I'd been blogging about, my family and I went to visit my mother. And that was the visit during which we realized that she could really not stay at home any longer. And all sorts of odd things were happening. And I think it was only 8 days we spent with her, where the things she was saying were odd and not true. And that was the point at which we started looking for a place for her to live after she left her own home. But so I was writing everything down. I think it was partly just a defense mechanism to make sure that I was writing all the time, which kept it from seeming so chaotic. So the form of it is very short prose pieces that are based very much on what I am seeing happening in front of me as accurately as I can see them, along with everything else, which included the stuff about the Bush administration on the television, things about my kids, things about my husband, and all of that got mixed together. Well, as I kept on writing it, I was struck by the fact that the blog form goes backwards in time. So when you open up a blog, you're reading today's entry. And then, if you keep reading in a sense forward in the blog, you're actually going backwards in time. And so, to read a blog is a very confusing thing because you're going backwards. But it occurred to me that that was very appropriate to the subject I was writing about, where often I would feel that I was getting the effect before the cause, or things were not in the right order. Or things were just really confusing and hard to figure out without sitting there and working through kind of what you were just saying about your dad not knowing you were a Red Sox fan. I'd be sitting there and thinking, my mother just told me that my father was an Irish Catholic, but no, that was her father. And so I decided to keep it when it became a book, keep it in the order of the blog so that you would see something and then you would see what happened before it later in the book. Now, a lot of people have told me that, well, I really like the book, but I confess I read it from the back to the front because I couldn't deal with the way you had structured it.
Oh no. Go
Yes.
ahead, go ahead.
But anyway, that's okay with me because it's still difficult. You can't read it backwards in that way either. You have to read a section and then go back and read the section before it and then go back and read the section before that. So there's still a kind of built-in difficulty of access to the material in the book. So either way, I think the form, in a lot of ways, engages with the content of the book.
I couldn't control my oh no reaction just because I love how the blogness is like right at the forefront as part of the technique of the book when I thought.
Yeah, well, the second volume I turned around, so it does follow chronological time because, the project ended with my mother's death. And there's a very different sense about starting from her death and moving backwards, which just doesn't work. the way in which the first volume worked was that the end of the book, which is the beginning, is when she moves into the Alzheimer's home. And that seemed like a transition that you could begin from, whereas in the next book, I felt like I had to move from where I started up again, which was in 2009, and move to her death in 2011. And there are lots of different approaches in the second volume too. It's there's the diaristic part, but there are also a lot of documentary pieces and little essays and imagined conversations and all sorts of other stuff going on in it.
And I like how that keeps what I was calling the blogginess alive also, because isn't that a blog has that kind of daybook feel too, that everything that's around us is just going in there, links and embedded links and embedded video, and it's not always single-pointed focus on one subject.
Right. So I guess that is pretty much my mode.
It is, I guess.
All things at once. And I think what the experience of doing this kind of writing has taught me is a corrective to what a lot of my students still think is true, which is that if you're going to write about an experience, you have to leave a decent amount of time between when it happened and when you write about it. And I no longer believe that. I think for me, it's important to write from inside that moment and see where that takes me.
And there's a sense, and I've had this has come up with my students also. I think if you're writing from inside that moment, you're writing from a perspective that, you know, everything is happening simultaneously, and we don't have to master that or order it. We just want to maybe chart it or map it.
Right. It's the ordering that actually goes against what happens in dementia. And what really bothers me about a lot of writing about Alzheimer's is that it insists on creating a narrative around it. And the narrative is precisely what falls apart when you have Alzheimer's. So why would you recreate it as something that made sense in time when it doesn't?
Yeah, it adds a whole to do so. I think it adds a whole layer of the artificial that doesn't always, I don't think, would serve the experience of dementia.
No, or the experience of being with someone with dementia, and I think it's their experience that's actually the most important thing to encounter. It's not necessarily your experience with it. It's their experience.
And you know, that reminds me of another thing. I was talking with a friend of mine whose mother is suffering from Alzheimer's, and we were sort of talking about the sense of that when you're with someone. If this is sort of on the subject of imposing or not imposing a narrative, you know, like when you're with someone who has Alzheimer's, you know, I think for some there's this instinct sometimes to want to correct them and say, like, well, no, that's not my father, that's your father. But instead, I think sometimes being with someone with Alzheimer's is just literally being with them, taking the ride with them wherever they're going, instead of trying to correct the narrative that they're messing up.
No, I think that's exactly it. And that takes, in the beginning, it takes some getting used to the notion that you can just let things go that you know are not quote unquote true and simply go with them, because it really is kind of that presence that's important and not the particular content, or especially not the logic of what's going on, that matters.
I'd like to shift a little bit and talk about your work as an editor and publisher with Tinfish. Can you talk a little bit about how you see your role as an editor and you know, maybe even the relationship between your own writing and your editing?
Oh, that's a great question. That's two questions at least.
It was kind of cheating, I know.
Okay, so the first one would be my role as editor. I think that inevitably changes over time. I started Tinfish in 1995 as a way to try to create a space somehow that would introduce a certain kind of experimental writing that happens on the American continent with a kind of writing in Hawaii that's not thought of as experimental, and to try to see what happened when those things got brought together. I mean, it was partly selfish because I'd moved from one place to another and I was trying to figure out sort of how to talk about it, how to think about it. But at that point, I think I was perhaps trying to form a community, trying to find a community, trying to highlight certain aspects of writing that hadn't been highlighted before. And the longer I'm with this, the less utopian I feel permitted to be. Mm. I mean, I don't find that the tinfish concept necessarily works as well as people simply reading one or the other of our books and using them as they will anyway, which of course is their prerogative, even if I'd rather have them read all the books at the same time and think about them in the ways that I want them to think about them. That doesn't seem possible. But it's a part of it is I like to encourage young writers in Hawaii and elsewhere in the Pacific. That's certainly one of the missions. We've done a lot of work that I guess you could say is influenced by colonialism and by different languages in the Pacific. We've also done some work that is much more engaged in Buddhism. So we did a chapbook by Norman Fisher. We did a book by Paul Naylor where he's meditating on a Japanese Zen Buddhist text. So we've got several emphases, but the newest volume is the oddest one of all and one that I would have sworn 10 years ago I would never ever embark upon. It is our first and probably last engagement with ethnic writing. But I'm doing the writing of Caucasian writers in Hawaii, which in some ways has seemed to be a rather taboo subject, and yet it exists. So I thought, you know, what the heck, no one else is going to do it. So I'll make a space in which white writers can think about how living in Hawaii has influenced their work, what they feel they can write about, what they can contribute to this place, and so on. So that's where we are now.
And that's the Jack London is Dead anthology.
That's the Jack yes. London mm-hmm. is Dead anthology. Now, I do realize people have kidded me. I do realize that Jack London is actually literally quite dead. But what I'm paying homage to is the Charlie Chan is Dead, yes. Jessica Hagedorn anthology of Asian American writing, at the same time that I'm asserting that the old canon of Hawaii literature, which was formed around, say, statehood, 1959, which pushed forward writers like Jack London and Herman Melville and Robert Louis Stevenson, who came and stayed a while and then wrote about it, foregrounded them as opposed to Hawaiian or other texts from this state, that's gone. And what we're dealing with is a very different situation, and we need to kind of return to this one kind of writing and see what's happened to it over the past 50 years.
To think about, when you say return to this one type of writing, to think about your Euro-American writers writing
right.
without, where whiteness isn't the normative standard, though.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Which is really interesting to collect that in an anthology and see how that question sort of is overarching for those writers. Sounds fascinating.
Right, because I think in Hawaii, as in many places, when you talk about white writers, you assume that they're dead. Mm-hmm. You know, the canon, right? The old canon is the dead white male writer. Well, I think that hangs over everything. And so I'm just kind of sticking out my chin and saying, well, there are actually quite a few living white writers here who are living in conditions unimagined by the Jack Londons of the world. So that's what I'm trying to put forward in this anthology.
So, yeah, conditions unimagined by the Jack Londons of this world, who are dead, but yeah, but alive in that way. Well, let's hear another poem.
Okay. Are you sure you don't want to call one out
Let
on
me
the
see.
jukebox?
Maybe I can call one out. Let me see something from the Oppen series. Let me find that. And this is another moment I can edit so that people don't have to endure me turning pages and saying
Okay.
and stuff.
Well,
Here we
it's
go.
nice that there still are pages, you know.
I know, exactly. Instead of endure me clicking something on an
Right.
iPad. Yeah. How about the Oppen series, February 10th, 2011, page 76?
Okay. Oh, good. I like this one. Okay, 10 February 2011. It is the air of atrocity that settles onto the tent city the square has become. Radhika can't decide why some words end in YS and others in IES. The differences between gurneys and families, between armies and pathways, are rule-bound, abstract. A young poet tortures himself on distinctions between night and night, between dawn and its opposite. He writes down ideas he cannot explain, and in not explaining, loses them. The police state parses its words less delicately, demands its children go home. Torture is clear speech, though what is gleaned from it is not. I was wearing a blood-stained shirt, one says. It marked him as one of them. I heard myself tell the boy to clarify his grammar, glue limbs to his poem's body. I ask him to construct a box for his cloud. Obama demands Mubarak clarify his language, spell it out. There's no future in telling. It's all show.
You've been listening to Susan Schultz on Radio Free Albion. Her most recent book is Memory Cards, 2010-2011 series from Singing Horse Press, and it's available everywhere that you buy books online, including independent sites like Small Press Distribution, spdbooks.org, and at bookstores that carry books of poetry from independent presses. And keep your eye out and your ear out for the companion volume to her dementia blog, which will be coming out in a couple months, also from Singing Horse. You can get to know Susan and her work more by visiting her blog, tinfisheditor.blogspot.com, and also tinfishpress.com. Thanks for coming on the show, Susan.
Oh, thanks so much, Tony.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Albion. If you're a poet and you'd like to be on a future show, or if you just want to email me and tell me what you thought of today's show, you can get in touch with me at Radio Free Albion, that's one word, radiofreealbion@gmail.com. You can also go to the show's Twitter page, twitter.com/radiofreealbion. Thanks again for listening.